Are there people here today that were not here yesterday? Thanks so much for being here. We're going to circle back a little bit to yesterday and sometimes ignore the fact that we can't do the same thing every day because there's a dynamic population coming and going. Well, yesterday it was kind of like it was the pedagogy of teaching as if I was a fire hose, spewing in all directions. And so it feels to me as if, and then now you've had an assignment overnight to read the Acts of Paul and Thecla. So you have firsthand impressions that that I don't have. And that's really always important. So I want to start today and here's kind of our agenda, questions, protests, and thoughts you have as you wake up this morning. I've actually had a number of each between yesterday and today from you, so that's going to really make wonderful fodder for our thinking. So let's just start with what are some important things that you've been thinking about just in terms of questions, thoughts, or protests about Thecla? Yes?
So as I was reading the Beatitudes in 5 and 6,
yeah,
and there some of them sounded kind of wackadoodle, and I'm thinking, I allow myself to describe this non-canonical thing as a little wacky.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, why don't I ever apply that same test to the stuff that made it into the canon?
Yeah, totally. Thank you. Great question. That's one of the things that I do in graduate intros to the New Testament, is notice how domesticated the canonical material is, and how wackadoodle it is. If you would be able to read it for the first time, I would also just want to say, if our domestication of canon generally has allowed us to miss so much of the surprise in it, or the wackadoodle. I'm seeing folks up here. You all have. You've got your handouts. Good. Okay. Thank you so much. I think that wasn't a question. That was a rhetorical wonder. Thank you. Yes.
I just was struck about the fiance and mother talking about loving her.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure they actually did, or if it was more, well, this is what she's supposed to do. Uh-huh. Who does she think she is?
Get your handouts if you haven't got them. So the question Elaine has is, did Thecla and her mother love each other, right?
Mm-hmm. And the fiancé. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fiancé.
And the fiancé, too. Does the fiancé and the mother love Thecla and vice versa? I'm in over my head there because I don't know for sure, but I would say, well, so the fiancé says explicitly that he loves her. What he means by that is a whole other question. I mean, the word love means a lot of different things, and so we wouldn't know what that means, but it seems like a straightforward expression to me. There are three Greek words, primary Greek words, and this is agape.
This is agape.
Uh-huh. And agape, frankly, in its use in the first and second centuries, is not agape in the common parlance. Does not mean love. It's a secondary word. I think it means more like affection in regular Greek in the first two words. So using agape through across the Christ movements, first and centuries, is meant to be innovative. So Eros and Philos and Philia are much more standard uses of love. So back to your question, I don't see in the text any indication that Thecla and her mother like each other at all. Except at the end, you may notice at the end of the story, or near the end of the story, Thecla, after having, you know, after her mother having wanted to, well, helped sentence her to death, Thecla tries to reconnect with her mother. And it's almost, it's fairly clear that Thecla is basically trying to reconnect and to help her mother with monetarily. And her mother rejects her. So that relationship is there. I don't know whether one can understand Thecla and her fiancé to have loved one another mutually. It doesn't seem as if Thecla is against the wishes of her fiancé to have a wife. She just knows that she doesn't want to be it. And it's not about him. It's about a general self-understanding.
This doesn't surprise me, knowing so many cultures, that marriage is just an economic arrangement.
Yeah.
And for status. And so children are things that get bought and sold. And
Yeah. So, and I'm going to turn this, I'll put this window down, because I'm hearing stuff from outside. And it's a little... There we go. Maybe that'll help us. So the definition of marriage in the ancient world, I think I would say just initially two things, and a number of us, I hope, can say more. But it is a category of non-equality. And in many cases, the law, both Roman law and Jewish law, considered the wife property. So this, I think, therefore, legally one has to think of it as some kind of slavery. So in other words, that is a possession, as I think you've said.
And
before.
Children.
Yeah. Yeah, and the second thing to say is that the first century BCE through the second century CE, things are in motion in terms of what a legal marriage. So for instance, in the first century BCE, before Rome takes over Israel, the queen of Israel pronounces that women have rights to property and to divorce. So that's in change. And that also happens in Roman law. Roman law, in this very time of the Christ movements, Roman law gives women property rights and gives women the right to divorce. Those are unbelievably crucial changes. So those laws are really resisted by the general population, or at least the general male population. So I think it's true that that one needs to think of it as a hierarchical relationship, even after the change in the laws. But there's something afoot in gender itself during these times. We'll get a chance to talk more about that. Other thoughts, difficulties, questions? Yes.
I was looking at I guess you call it chapter 26, and when Alexander saw Petra and became enamored with her, he tried to persuade Paul with money and guilt.
Yeah.
Paul said, "I do not know the woman of whom you speak, nor is she mine." What kind of relationship did Paul and Petra have right there? He said that with Alexander, they need to buy her.
Yeah, exactly.
Passage.
Oh, that's just a wonderful passage to think through. First of all, of course, this is, and we'll talk a little bit about more about this yet today. But so Paul is, there's got a lot of weird, good and bad stuff in Paul in this text, and this is just Paul as wuss. I mean, Paul is saying no, don't know her. But he's her mentor. So he's simply ducking because one of the leaders of the town, of the city, is approaching. So he doesn't want to have anything to do with her. I think most kind to Paul, you could say he is trying to save her by not knowing her because people are against him. I think that's pushing it a little bit. I think he's just dodging it for himself, as he is a number of times. So, you know, there are several times in which she needs him, he isn't there for her. And then, yes, buying her, that's exactly what we're talking about. There's a masculine assumption that you can have a woman as property. Whether Alexander wants to marry her or not is not clear. I would assume that finding a woman, a beautiful woman on the street, that's the way it's described, he would assume he has privileges over her physically and sexually that would not necessarily include marriage.
This is just a comment, but I think we should kind of school ourselves into thinking critically about what property is and buying and selling people, because it's quite a different context here, and we kind of come to it with our own economic understandings. And I also think that Tekla was not a slave, therefore she was probably exchanged in this way that we would call property, but she was very much a medium for making alliances. So I would rather influence or emphasize the political aspect of these mm-hmm. sort of negotiations mm-hmm. rather than kind of placing our economic understandings of property into the equation.
That's really helpful to lay alongside the other edge of the other comment. Mm-hmm. And I would also say, in terms of slavery, and of course, Paul calls himself a slave in this text. And I don't think that's metaphorical either. I think Paul thinks of himself in slavery, and the term slave Paul uses across a lot of literature for himself. But one of the real mistakes of Americans, or North Americans, is to assume that slavery in the ancient Near East and Mediterranean means the same as slavery in America. Mm-hmm. The American slavery is much more cruel than ancient slavery. It's not as if it's a happy time to be a slave in the ancient world, but there are tons of ways in which a slave in the ancient world has more rights, and this is right alongside of what you say, than assuming that it's the chattel slavery of America. Other thoughts, questions, additions? Okay, well, good. We're cooking. This is exactly where I want to be. So the other thing I want to just say a little bit about is what I call the funny family of texts in the first and second century. And you led us this way a little bit before. So It's important to know that the canon in existence when Thecla was written. You remember from yesterday that we don't know when Thecla was written. and the introduction in the handout acts like I don't know, and I really don't. It's somewhere probably in the second century, but some people are pushing it back into the first. So really, the canon is established, and we'll have a little talk of this, I think, during this week. The canon is established probably in the 5th or 6th century. When I was in seminary, I was told the 4th century, and it turns out that that's pretty goofy in terms of what I was taught. So you don't have the notion of a New Testament for 4 or 5 more centuries on this. So, in other words, I want to say that so it looks like most of the people in the various Christ movements of the first and second century were illiterate. It's 90 to 95% of the general population in the Mediterranean are illiterate. And probably more in the Christ movements, which is a bit more of inhabited by people who are poorer. Reading and writing is a public act in the ancient world. In other words, and this is fun, and we have these wonderful texts that talk about how you learn to read and write. And this is just wonderful, because if you would see a young person, let's say 12 years old, learning to read and write, when she or he is learning to read, she will always be reading out loud. In other words, there is no such thing as going off and reading your book quietly in the ancient world, because you assume your ability to read is for everybody. So, for instance, if you think of a letter from Paul to a community being handed out, it's going to be lucky that some of those communities have anybody in the assembly that know how to read. We have to rethink that. At the same time, it looks like the Christ people of the first and second century really were active in writing. So in other words, there's a lot of stuff going out that is being written. And then in the second century, it's just a flood of stuff. So we're only just now in the 20th and 21st century coming to terms with how much writing went on in the first two centuries. In your handout, I put a little bit in about that from some of my work. But what we need to know is that in the 21st century, we understand the writing activity of the first two centuries of the Christ movement as very powerful. For instance, in the last 150 years of us, in the last 150 years, we've discovered about 150 new pieces of writing from the ancient Near East and North Africa. What I want to say is this is just like the New Testament in its 27 writings, has different, I mean, it disagrees with itself a lot. But then multiply that to say 200 writings. You have what I call a funny family of texts, in which there's overlapping convictions, fights, and just ignoring one another. in different places at different times. So let's put the Acts of Paul and Thecla, which is the major second century piece on Thecla. Let's put that in this big family, kind of a sloppy family of texts, of people who were somehow associated with Jesus or Christ. They'll disagree about that word too. All kind of coming helter-skelter. So Paul and Thecla, I've said yesterday, is almost certainly one of the very most popular books of all that time. In the second century, it's full of controversy about her because people like her so much. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the writing is negative against her because people like her so much. And there's a whole different thing. And remember, there's nobody even thinking about putting all the Christ movements together in an orderly fashion. So we can't project a unanimity of Christian thinking back on that. It's mainly let a thousand flowers bloom. So I just want to place that context as one, and many of you know that this is one of the major parts of my work in the last 20 years, is to integrate our conversation, our knowing, and our spirituality into the larger family of texts, rather than just a canonical family of texts. And I'm happy to have disagreement and interest on that front. Okay, so thoughts or questions about the funny family? Yes.
The councils, the seven early church councils, I'm trying to piece together, I'm thinking 3rd century, 4th century into the 7th century. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
And aren't those efforts to limit isn't the right word, to clarify what the early church held about Jesus and God in general, as opposed to the multitude of other ideas that were out there?
Right. Yeah, so that you began in the 3rd century agrees with what I was suggesting, is that the first two, they don't quite get that idea. There are some people who say, everybody should agree with me, but they're not efforts in the first 2 centuries in that regard. The other main thing, in a New Testament, I have a chapter on how the canon came into being. And there, the amazing thing is that none of those seven councils were interested in saying anything about what's in the New Testament.
Okay.
Yes.
This is also a question, was Jesus a reader?
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, the standard thing, you need to remember I'm lying half the time because I don't know and pretend I do. So I would want to say that scholars are in disagreement about that. There's no consensus of scholarship in this time. I would say in my lifetime, it has switched from assuming Jesus was a reader to assuming that he's not. So now the majority of scholars, I would say, not a huge majority, would say, no, he doesn't. Interestingly, in the New Testament, Jesus reads once.
I know, that's what I was thinking.
And that's in Luke. But Luke upgrades everything. because Luke's a wealthy person as well, Luke in parentheses. So that Jesus gets to read in Luke is like Jesus gets everything more in Luke.
Okay.
There are tiles on roofs in Luke that aren't in Matthew and Mark.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got, so in other words, not only is this the steep climb of learning about Thecla. In other words, all of a sudden you've got to spend a week with Thecla, and I'm saying it was one of the most important works of the first two centuries, and now I want to just put that in that is in a mix of a helter-skelter literary situation. Yes, Roger.
Just regarding the idea of the disparate communities that, in a sense, if I'm hearing you right, had an existence and that there wasn't this attempt to synthesize and to organize these mm-hmm. communities. Mm-hmm. In the light of that comment, I suppose the popular assumption of Paul's role in writing to different communities and the extent to which there was some kind of ministry of oversight of sorts that was maybe being exercised through those writings of his, recognizing that only some of the Pauline literature was authentically Paul. Could you just comment on that? Does that not then suggest that there was some impetus, at least, in terms of a kind of a being in relationship mm-hmm. with these mm-hmm. diverse yeah. communities? So yeah, I'm sure.
Lovely. See, this is why we come to Holden, to get these kind of conversations going. That's really important. So if you ask, did Paul think he was in charge of the seven communities that he wrote to? The answer is yes. He thinks they should jump when he says jump. And he thinks he has given birth to most of them. But what we have, so for instance, in Philippians, he says he wants to cut off their penises, he's so mad at them. He calls the Galatians names. In 1 and 2 Corinthians is the best piece of evidence that he wrote for the first letter to Corinthians, and it's quite clear in the second letter to the Corinthians that they wrote back and disagreed with him mostly. And he is fighting mad in 2 Corinthians. So, I would want to say, yes, he's in charge, according to him. But especially, for instance, what's clear that there are some really good books on this. Antoinette Weyer, I think, is the best on the Corinthians. There, in the Corinthian supper clubs where they meet, women are in charge of many of those, and Paul even mentions them. And people are understanding their ability to talk to Jesus directly. So it doesn't seem like they think they need letters from Paul to be fully who they are. Your second question, I think, is even more important, though. Do they want to belong to one another? If you look at a lot of the literature, you would say some do and some don't. But you have a few people that call themselves bishops. Not every group has bishops. But let's just say Ignatius of Antioch in the early to mid-second century. He gets fired as a bishop. And by the way, the word bishop means administrator. So he gets fired in Antioch. And on his way to Rome, where he wants to die for Jesus, nobody's forcing him, he starts saying what all the churches along the way should do because he's bishop. He doesn't really mention he's a fired bishop. Whatever that meant. And it was just the local people in Antioch said, no, you go away. So there are impulses to bring people together, and there are general appreciations of one another. So when you read one letter, Paul says, hey, you know, the people from Thessalonica say hi. And so-and-so in another place gave me some money. So I would say, yeah, there are. And that grows some within the second century. But by the end of the second century, you've got a lot of people calling some movements bad and others good. How am I doing, Roger?
Yeah, great.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to move on. I want to talk a little bit about Rome and Empire and Thecla here. And forgive me, I'm going to... I know that some of you probably haven't thought a lot about the Roman Empire and the early Christ movements, and some of you have. I want to just say that it's been a huge discovery within the last 40 or 50 years in studying those first two centuries, that it mattered what the Roman Empire did to this movement. In fact, many of us say it's probably the most important thing to know about the early Christ movements is they were under the thumb of Rome, because Rome controlled the entire Mediterranean. And Rome was violent and dominating. There are lots of ways of thinking about this, but one is that, for instance, it looks like most of the big titles for Jesus were first titles of Augustus Caesar. So, for instance, Son of God, Lord of all, Maker of peace, all of those titles are not given to Jesus first. They are titles that Augustus Caesar, the first emperor of everything, and that he gives himself. He says, I'm Lord of all. He says, I'm the Maker of peace, because I've dominated all of the nations that were trying to compete with me. And I'm the Son of God. So when, and of course we need to think that it was the emperor who, and the emperor's people who killed Jesus. In other words, crucifixion is a legal punishment for leading a rebellion against Rome. Rome didn't use crucifixion that way. It used it much more plentifully. So, for instance, Pilate, he says that in his 10 years as governor of Judea, he crucified 10,000 people. That's just a tiny piece of Rome. So we have to assume hundreds of thousands of people are crucified in the time of Jesus. And this was an ingenious move on Rome's part, which is having trouble controlling all of its territory. So they just like to go into towns and crucify anybody. And what a great idea, I said laughing, to hang people up in public places and watch them die for 3 days. And then to let the birds and the dogs eat their bodies. Or and after that happens, you put them in a mass grave. This is a way to make sure that you think twice or three times before you say something wrong against Rome. And so Jesus is known as the person, the thing that more people know about Jesus than anything else is that he was tortured to death. And then the Christ people start calling him by the person who crucified him by names of Lord of all, bringer of peace, and Son of God. That's full of irony. That the person who gets tortured to death, now we're going to give Caesar's names to him. There are plenty of things to say about this Rome thing. But I just want to say that now we have in Thecla the story of someone who is by Roman authorities. They try to kill her three times. So this, and that the gender contestation about her is a part of male superiority according to Rome. Caesar also calls himself the father of all. And so that she and God, the other God, not Caesar, line up together to foil her death is a stunning story. No wonder it's really popular. And similarly, she is a woman in this leadership position. So she's a healer and a teacher. In this very fraught atmosphere. So that's a short version of what a bunch of us have learned in the last 50 years. I mean, when I went to seminary, no one taught me anything about Rome. All we did was learn about Jesus in relationship to Jewish people. And of course, we see that kind of mistake also in the Gospels themselves, where Rome's importance is brought down, and Judeans people are blamed for the death of Jesus. So I just want to say this about the context of the Thecla's becoming a teacher and a healer, despite Roman authorities trying to kill her because she won't marry. Thoughts, questions, protests?
Are there other references outside of this particular one about Thecla?
Yes, but this is probably the earliest. Thecla continues to be a huge hero in emerging Christianity forever, but between the 3rd and 6th century, I'd say maybe 30 books are written about her, and they get more and more exaggerated and heroic the longer you write. So you also need to remember that the 3rd through the 6th century is the flowering of the literature on martyrs. And this is an interesting counterpoint, because between the 3rd and the 6th century, you're trying to make sense of what it means to be a Christ person because you die with Christ. Here is a story of someone who beats the odds and dies of old age, parked in the cemetery next to Paul. I know, again, there are 8 different cemeteries that Paul's supposed to be buried in. Maybe a lot of women do. Yes?
I don't totally disagree with you on the attributes of Jesus being described in terms of empire. Warren Carter has been doing work on this stuff, I think, for years on empire.
Yeah.
But my question is whether there are any connections between Old Testament ideas of God as Lord of all, as creator, or the messianic, what we call messianic, the ideas of the one who is going to come and be a peacemaker or a prince of peace. So are there any, are you, can you make connections out of the Hebrew scriptures that may lead to Jesus' same kinds of description, or are you arguing that it's those titles to Jesus are entirely Roman?
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much. No, it would be really impossible to say that there's no relationship. Matter of fact, I'd love to build on what you're saying. So one of the problems with Israel for the Romans is they have a God who is the only God. And the two main wars of the first two centuries that Rome is against Israel. And that's not an accident. So I would want to completely agree with you that Rome thinks that Israel is a danger partly because of its monotheism. Now, Rome is quick to point out that it's a tiny little country. But that's Roman rhetoric. And so Jesus and Paul belong to the people of Israel. Both of them say they belong to the people of Israel. And so that has to be said, what you're saying. But all I would say is both Israel and Jesus are enemies of Rome, in the eyes of Rome. And both the people of Israel, the followers of Jesus, and most everybody else in the Mediterranean is really scared to death of Rome because of its violence and its willingness to kill and enslave hundreds of thousands of people. So there's no way that what I tried to summarize in 5 minutes can't include Israel. Matter of fact, if you look at Roman coins at the end of the first century, most of the coins are celebrating the defeat of Israel by Rome and the destruction of Israel's temple. So I want to say Jesus being crucified and the destruction of the temple, although they happen 40 years apart, they belong in the same picture, both of the early Christ people and of Rome, and the people who belong to Israel. Am I?
Yeah.
Great. Yes.
Helen, in the light of the violence of Rome's oppression that you've described as a way of imposing their domination, in the light of it, you made a comment there within the Gospels, and I think John's Gospel would be a good example, where the emphasis seems to fall more in terms of the responsibility and culpability of the Jews,
mm-hmm.
In terms of the crucifixion of Jesus, when clearly it was at the hands of Rome that he was murdered. Do you think that that's then an example of a kind of almost like a self-censorship that's taking place precisely because of the violence of Rome? And as a consequence, how do you account for that particular emphasis within the gospel narrative?
I don't think any of us are doing a very good job on figuring that out. We acknowledge it. I think the main clarification that's happening in the last 20 years on that thought is the word Jew. So the problem there is that almost all our New Testaments have a bad translation of the Greek word iodios, meaning Jew. So the word Jew really doesn't come into meaning the Jew, a belonging to a religion, until the second or third century. We really should translate that word Judean Because that it's actually, that would be a transliteration of Iodiales. And so, in other words, this is a party within Israel, spiritual Israel, that are the Gospel of John especially writes about as being responsible for Jesus' death. This is an inter-Jewish, so the picture of Jesus being killed is a, in I think in the Gospels, more a complex relationship among the people of Israel who have been taken over by Rome and who are fighting actively with one another about what to do about the miserable situation they're in. And so in almost every conquered country, then and now, you don't have unity within the people who are being conquered.
Yeah.
That's not adequate to your question, Roger.
That's helpful.
You want to go on? Gender? We talked quite a bit about gender in yesterday's conversation, but I just want to rehearse that and think a little bit more about this. So you may have noticed in your reading of the Acts of Paul and Thecla that she cuts off her hair and she dresses as a man. Now why does she do that? Basically because it's safer for her as a woman. If she's a healer and a teacher, she's out in public. Now it is true that in the Mediterranean under Rome, women have more and more rights to be in public. It's still kind of dangerous. And so one of the things she does is she cross-dresses and masculinizes herself. I think it's really important to think about this, and we're just getting started on this, but I think that's more than costume. I think that is her beginning to what I would call queer herself, to see herself as something else than man or woman. And that she self-understands that she is, that her break with marriage says a lot about who she is and who people can be. And that marriage is seen very much as I said, implied yesterday, as an institution of domination by the male. And here I want to emphasize not so much the domination of women, which is true in marriage of the time, but the domination of children, of adult children, as I alluded yesterday. So it's really difficult for a non-married woman to get outside the realm of control of her father. The same applies to sons who are not firstborn. The only way you get out is through marriage. And for women, that's a difficult choice because that's going to the person above you that you know to a person above you whom you don't know. Remember, as Barb said earlier, it's an exchange that's not built on affection to marry someone. So here, I want us to begin to play with the possibility that there's not just one Thecla, but there are thousands of them in Christ communities everywhere. that the Christ communities are most likely made up of a majority of women. And I alluded to this yesterday. I want to think about the widows. So for instance, if you read so much of the early Christ literature, they're talking about the widows. I love the piece in 1 Timothy. I don't love 1 Timothy at all, frankly, because it's a diatribe against women. But one of the things that 1 Timothy does to put down women is to say, you can't be a deacon until you're 60. Now that's interesting, they can't be a deacon at all, right? In some cases. But what's clear there is that this is about the widows. Because what happens when people's husband dies, often they have no place to go. And therefore, and in many cases in the Roman Empire, you don't know how to have money enough to live on or a place to live on. And you often are come at by men in public as a prostitute. So what is happening to the early Christ movements in the first and second century is that there are at least a plurality, if not a majority, of women seeking support. And that she's one of them. And so you may have noticed in the Acts of Paul and Thecla, Paul is accused of telling the women they can't get married. We don't know whether he did that. I mean, tomorrow we'll look at 1 Corinthians and what he does say in chapter 7 about being married and him saying, I'm not going to do it. But here it says clearly that he's accused of keeping them from them being married. So in Paul and Thecla, even though Paul is somewhat of a problematic character in the book itself, he is saying the way to God's freedom is not to marry. And I just, as I said yesterday, and I'll say this a little bit clearer today, just think how well that works. So we Protestants, I hope there are some Catholics in the room, but we Protestants have ignored the category of celibacy and put it down. I want to propose in the early Christ movements, it's not primarily about whether you have intercourse. It's about whether you marry or not. And there, what is at stake is the possibility of belonging to a fictive family, an imaginary family of Christ people, where you are loved and not dominated. So in this regard, it makes social and economic sense for the Christ movements to be attracting women who are in danger. And what happens in the Acts of Paul and Thecla is that here you have someone who's a teenager and who gets that logic. Here's Paul. And so when she's listening through the window of Paul, what Paul is saying, I want to say, it's not in the book, is don't marry. And she's thinking, oh. So gender here, I think automatically, because, and I need to say that men are also becoming celibate in this time and joining the Christ movements for similar reasons, especially those who are second and third born and don't get married. To break out of the domination of the father in the family in order to be part of a family or you belong more. I don't want to say that the early Christ movements are egalitarian. That's probably too big a statement. But it's less dominating than the family. And so how does Thecla see herself gender-wise? I think that contemporary, in the last 30 or 40 years, gender studies really help us. That there aren't just two genders. And she's entering into another gender. As we're learning in our day, a lot of other people are. All right, that's a mouthful. Yes?
I'm curious about the gender crossing, the gender queerness dress. Where is that in the text? Because I don't remember. I was wondering if you could just point to
what, where she
talks about her clothing and kind of dressing more masculine.
Yeah, right.
I see the hair in 25. I will cut my hair short and follow you wherever you go.
Yeah, that's the only one.
Is there anything about the clothing? Or?
I just know that from a bunch of other things that women are doing in that time. It's and the clothing is also in there. Yeah.
What chapter is that?
I can't remember.
40.
Oh, okay.
40. Okay. Oh, yeah, 40. I got it.
Oh, a robe in the fashion of a man. Okay, mm-hmm. I just remember.
She bound herself up and attached together her garment and robe in the fashion of a man.
And so the text also doesn't say what I said. I'm wanting to think actively about that not just being costuming for her, but a way of stepping into another kind of family. And that being, that would, and I think our contemporary term of gender would help us think about her in that way. This is new things to think about for some of you. So happy
to. Is it fair to wonder her departure from her father's home? I'm up here.
Oh.
She leaves her father's home in dominance, but she attaches herself to another man who she follows around persistently despite the fact that he's not really, doesn't seem to really want him, her in his family.
Yeah, yeah.
There's still that... that father figure thing going on, seems to me.
Oh, and the thing that makes me most uncomfortable is when he's in jail and she goes and kisses his feet. So, yeah, I frankly think, this is where I take it, but I don't know at all whether, and we're so new to this. I think that Paul is intentionally, I think that, yes, the text doesn't want her, it wants to portray her as doing that and it not working out. Or it not being especially great. Because it has these times in which he fails her. But she, and sometimes she goes looking for him and she can't find him. So, yes, I think that's the way. That happens to all of us when we are trying to change one part of our life. We fall into another trap. So I would tend to say that's fairly intentional in the writing of the book to make for there to be intention for this not to be ideal. That's the best I got. You want to say something more about that?
I didn't think about that as being a... her attempting to adopt Paul as a father figure. I just thought she was just so enamored with what he was teaching.
What do you think about the kissing of the feet? Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know what to think about that either.
But it parallels. Yeah. It copies Mary and Jesus.
Yeah, yeah, that could be too. And in Hebrew thought, kissing the feet is a euphemism for sex.
Ruth and Boaz. Yeah, Ruth and Boaz.
Yeah. Time's up. We'll go get him tomorrow. Thanks. I'm going to hang here. Oh, by the way, anybody who wants to come and join the playmaking, you're still welcome, as I said this morning at breakfast, 10:30 across the way. And I'll just hang here for a while if you want to.